Okay, we'll start. Couple of things. I want to remind you that Ken Rinpoche is teaching Tundruk starting this Sunday at 2 o'clock. 1 o'clock? That's unusual. Seriously?
Double header.
Oh. Okay. 1 o'clock. Don't miss it, okay? You'd be totally crazy to miss it, all right? And I think his book is coming out soon in conjunction with that. So don't miss it. You're just totally crazy if you miss it. Yeah, you have to have an initiation for that. I asked Rinpoche if you've had Chakrasambhara or Yamantaka Anuttara yoga initiation with all the necessary, with all four initiations, then it's okay if you haven't had Vajrayogini. But he said Kala Chakra was not enough, okay? Because oftentimes they don't, His Holiness doesn't give the full initiation through the Kala Chakra. So it will not be enough to just to have the Kala Chakra to come. So you either have to have Chakrasambhara, Yamantaka, Vajrayogini. If you're not sure, ask me, okay? All right. Also, we're very honored that Lama Serpa will be doing a fire offering. No good? Sound? Need more sound. Not loud enough? No. We're very honored to have Lama Sopa. I think he's going to be doing a fire puja tonight or tomorrow. For him, it's all the same. at Godstow. And I thought we should, it'd be nice to offer him a little Kungat Dundrup. Do you know Kungat Dundrup? Kunga means makes everybody happy. Dundrup means gets all things done. It's a Tibetan word for money. So anybody want to take care of that, take up an offering for Debbie? Okay. Just go around during the break. And I'd like to offer some too. And just to, we might as well get a cut of his virtue. All right? 10%, right? So I'd just like to offer him something towards the cost of the fire offering he's doing, things like that. And then maybe a little note, okay? Something like that. It just says we're honored to have him doing that. Okay, bless the place. Okay. As Winston so eloquently started the Lojong, now I get to finish it, okay? And thank you for that, wherever he is. Okay. Oh, all right. Okay. I like the... I get to cover Shemba Shidra. Say Shemba.
Shemba.
Shida.
Shida.
Shemba.
Shemba.
Shida.
Shida.
By the way, one more offering we have to do. Maybe you can help me with that. Rinpoche said that he might want to rent a porta potty for Sunday. So can you call him and ask him if he's serious and that we'd like to offer it? Okay. I think it'd be nice to take some pastries. Who wants to head that up for Sunday? So just to take some pastries from New York for the class on Sunday. Anybody? How about Gail? Okay. Just, you know, the three students who have money in the class, you know who they are. There used to be more, but... Okay. Shemba means... but I'd like to offer it during the break. From New York people, okay? And if you can tell Rinpoche we're planning that, so he doesn't have to buy a lot. Okay, so we'll do the cause and the effect. All right. Shemba. But result first and cause second, which is very tantric. Okay. Shemba means attachment. She means four. Tel means, some of my students can't pronounce this right. They say Ndrao, which means connected. Tel means disconnected, so you have to be careful with this one, okay? Shemba Shidel means free of the four attachments. Got worse, right? It's that guy. You didn't do this to Bill Clinton, did you? He did Clinton a few months ago and got to ask him about Tibet, and Clinton said he couldn't do anything. Anyway, Shemba Shidel, freedom from the four attachments, okay? I'm going to read them to you in English. A person who is still attached to this life is no Dharma practitioner. That's number one. A person who is still attached to this life is no Dharma practitioner. Second one is a person who is attached to the three worlds has no renunciation. Three worlds are basically the desire realm, the form realm, and the formless realm. Okay? Meaning this world, this broken realm that we're in. Okay? Number three, a person who is still attached to getting what they want is no bodhisattva. Number four, a person who still grasps to things has no worldview. Meaning grasps to things self-existently, right? As existing. A person who still grasps to things has no worldview. Okay? Those are called the four attachments, and then the purpose of this lojong is to get free of them. I want to talk a little bit about the lineage of this lojong. Fourth one again is a person who still grasps to things, meaning self-existently, has no worldview. Sorry? Number two, a person who is still attached to the three worlds has no renunciation. Your class leaders will give them to you. Okay. I like to tell people that it's important to do this Sakya Lojong because really the early teachers who came to Mongolia were the Sakyas. You know the story, Godan Khan, grandson of Genghis Khan, came to the edge of Tibet, eastern edge of Tibet, to collect the tribute. The Tibetans were not invaded by Genghis Khan, as everybody else was. You see, Korea, Vietnam, China, Moscow was taken by the Khan. That's why so many people in Russia look Mongolian. All of the Middle East, like Persia, northern India, he got down into Vietnam. He took basically the entire world. Outside of Vienna, in one day, they killed 400,000 Viennese troops, and were about to march into Vienna. We would all be speaking Mongolian. The Hungarians still speak a Mongolian dialect. But they turned back because they got message, three-year message, sent 3 years before down the line, that the Khan had died, Genghis Khan. And they turned around and went home. Okay. Anyway, the Tibetans stopped paying as soon as they heard that the Khan had died, and the Tibetans never got attacked because they just paid basically, what do you call it? Tribute. What do they call it? It was grocery stores in New York. Protection money. Okay. Okay. And so Godan Khan came to collect the protection money again, the grandson. And on the border, he began to take an interest in Buddhism. He sent a message to what he heard was the greatest Buddhist teacher at the time, was the Sakya Pandita, and sent a message to him. And we still have the message. It's very beautiful. It says, I'm taking an interest in Buddhism. I've heard that you are interested in liberating all living beings. I am a living being, and I request you to teach me Buddhism. And if you don't come and teach me Buddhism, I'll destroy all the monasteries in eastern Tibet. We still have this letter. So Sakya Pandita was already an old man. He was very old at the time. And fearing that, and he kept getting stopped on the way to teach, which was very common, even with people like Lama Sopa and stuff like that. So he was afraid he'd be late, so he sent ahead, as a good faith measure, his two nephews to meet the Khan as sort of like a ransom. Then the one nephew named Pakpa actually had converted the Khan before the Sakya Pandita even got there. And this Pakpa went on to be the main Lama of the Mongolians. He invented one of the Mongolian scripts that they used to write. He became the court Lama of Kublai Khan in the court in Beijing, and met Marco Polo there, and Marco Polo wrote about him. So he's a very illustrious. He also invented the mandala offering that we do, the long one. That's called Pakpa's mandala offering. Things like that. The Sakya Pandita's nephew was Pakpa, and Sakya Pandita's uncle was called, let me get this straight. Sakya Pandita's uncle was named Drapa Gyaltsen. Okay? And Drapa Gyaltsen is very important in our Vajrayogini lineage. Okay? One of the most important lamas for Dzogrim. He is the source for teachings on one of the branches of the Dzogchen tradition that we do in Vajrayogini. Okay? So I thought it would be auspicious if we studied his commentary. So what you have in your reading is Drapa Gyaltsen's commentary. Drapa Gyaltsen was the nephew of Sachen, who had the vision of Manjushri, who taught him these as a 12-year-old boy. Okay? Anyway, that's your lineage. Pakpa went on. Buddhism stretched all the way to the front lines of the empire, the Mongolian Empire. As the empire shrank, there was a certain number of Mongolians left behind. And in the 1700s, on Christmas Eve, 1776 or something, on Christmas Eve, they decided to go back home to Jungaria, Mongolia, and the river didn't freeze that night. They got the word from the fifth Dalai Lama, I think, at that time, who said, go on this night, you know. And that night, the river didn't freeze. And the Mongolians were separated on two sides of the river. So all the Mongolians on the east side of the river came back to Mongolia and actually were slaughtered on the way. There's a few pockets of them left in western China or something. Then the ones on the western side of the river got stuck. And they say that the old word in Mongolian for left behind is halmak, or halm. So they got left behind and they were called the Kalmyks. And then they became the protectors of the southern border of the Russian Empire when the Russian Empire began to grow. And then they were allowed to join this secret Christian society called the Cossacks, military society. They sided with the wrong side in the revolution to protect the Tsar. Tsar got killed. The Cossacks were disbanded. And that's when the Kalmyks began to run away. Carmen's father and Lily Umarikov, who comes to class sometimes, father, were actually trained in the Cossacks and had scars. And you had to have scars on your face and stuff like that. Anyway, that's how... Then the great Kalmyk teacher was, what's his name? Gurdjieff. Tried to convince the Tsar, convince the Dalai Lama, that 13th Dalai Lama, that the Tsar was an emanation of Chenrezig Sikh, I think. And Russia was ready to join with Tibet and become one country. As a sign of unity, they built a temple in St. Petersburg together named the Kalachakra Temple. And then Dorjev had a student named Wangyal, Geshe Wangyal, who came to the United States, taught... Professor Thurman, Jeffrey Hopkins, Christopher George, and all those guys. And then brought Rinpoche here in 1972, I think it was, or something like that. So that's your lineage. You are in the lineage of the Sakya Mongol teachers. You see what I mean? So that's just a short explanation of what lineage you are. Okay, that's how you got here. Was through the kindness of the Mongols. All right? So it's nice to pay them back. Anyway, I wanted to talk about the one Shenpa Shido where it says, the first one, whosoever is still attached to this life is no Dharma practitioner. And in Drapa Gyaltsen's commentary, Jetson Drapa Gyaltsen's commentary, by the way, Drapa Gyaltsen was a layman and a great master of Buddhism. He was a layman with lifetime vows and also with a celibacy vow. And then he's actually the source for some of the most secret teachings of Vajrayogini. Okay? He explains it very, very interestingly. He says that attachment to this life is already in the context of a Buddhist practitioner, meaning a person who's already a good practitioner. So I like his explanation because I think it speaks to most of us. Most of you have been through at least a couple of courses. Some of you have been through up to 10 or 20 years of classes with great lamas. And Drapa Gyaltsen is explaining this text, these simple four lines that were taught to a 12-year-old boy by an emanation, okay? Sachen, Kunga Gyaltsen. He's explaining these in terms of great practitioners. And he says, attachment to this life isn't at all what you think it is in this context. Attachment to this life in this context means attachment to what you grew up with. Attachment to the worldviews that you grew up with, okay? Doing your practice for the wrong reasons, okay? And then he starts to give a long list. And I'm going to I'm going to go through some of them, okay? What it means to be attached to this life in the sense of attached to your, to what you grew up with. You see what I mean? And what he's saying is, he goes through a whole list of worldviews, okay? First one I would say would be your parents, right? And you have to be free of attachment for the worldview of your parents. You see what I mean? That's one of the most dangerous attachments. Doesn't mean you should abandon your parents. No. Doesn't mean you should be unkind to your parents. No. I was preparing text for the database, the ACIP database today, because John Brady's making me. And not really. And I got to a text by Kwencho Tembe Dume, which is a whole text on how to repay your parents' kindness. You know, so he wrote a book on it and in the 1700s. And so, no, it doesn't mean to diss your parents or junk your parents or anything like that. It just means you have to examine the worldview that you inherited from your parents. And don't believe what you believe just because your parents told you. I can give some personal examples, you know. My parents grew up in a time when it was considered very sophisticated to drink hard alcohol. You know what I mean? Like, you had to know, I mean, my father would brag about knowing 25 different ways to make vodka drinks, you know, and it had all these exotic names, and he had to go out and search for exotic mixers and stuff like that, and it was considered very manly. Like, he would read Hemingway, he would fish for marlin, he'd drink, you know, special drinks, you know what I mean? And that was considered very manly. And then I remember, you know, taking me out, here's your first drink, everything like that. It was very, very important to get it right, you know, very important to smell the wine the right way and everything else, and very important to know what kind of whiskey is better than another whiskey. They all taste the same. That's just the wrong view. That's just a totally wasted, ridiculous, insane, crazy wrong view. It costs a lot of money. It has absolutely no benefit to human beings. It's ruined the lives of countless people, including my parents. Probably gave both of my parents cancer. You know, ruined their whole life. You know what I mean? And so that, but if I had just bought into my parents' worldview, I would be doing that now. And I almost did, you know. I can remember going to the bar for the first hard drink, you know, and being very proud. And my dad would be proud of me, you know. When I was 12 years old, my father sent me to NRA marksmanship school. And so I could learn to shoot deer. And I remember getting my first .22 rifle. And he told me how to shoot squirrels and birds, and then I could move up to a 270 Remington the following, you know, 3 years later and shoot deer with him. And my high school would give us time off during hunting season. And this is just a lousy, terrible karma that I grew up with. But then those are two that are obviously wrong. But you have dozens that you're carrying from your parents that you just believe because your parents taught you that. You see, I mean, no other reason than that your parents taught you that. You have no better reason to be thinking the way you think except that your parents taught you that. You see, I mean, so Shenba Shidel, first of the four attachments, examine the views that you have inherited from your parents and reject the ones that are harmful, okay? That's just first one. It doesn't mean to disrespect your parents. If you go to their house for dinner, you don't, like, throw the wine bottle down the toilet or something. You just say, no, thank you. You know, I can't drink that. You know, I have a liver thing, you know. Okay. Something like that. Okay. Parents. School. You know, a lot of my worldviews came from I think of her name, okay, this is no joke, Mrs. Butts, okay, in the fifth grade, and she was just like that, and, okay, and just ridiculous viewpoints of the world, you know, like, if Oprah had been around, it would have just been straight Oprah Winfrey, you see what I mean, like, her whole worldview, her whole idea of what was right and wrong, important to do, chocolate, bridge, playing bridge, eating chocolates, watching TV, you know. Couldn't believe that I hadn't read Life magazine, you know, that week or something, you know, things like that. And you know, sometimes I remember going back and visiting them, and they're just frightening. You know, their whole worldview was culled from the Arizona Republic newspaper and TV. And what's that show? I forget. Anyway, TV shows, you know, it's like Archie Bunker. It was all from that. And the whole worldview was drawn from that. I remember one thing they told us, the Russians are evil, horrible, deadly people trying to kill us. You know, they made us hide under the desk in case the atom bomb was, like, it's going to help you to hide under a desk, right? Years later, I went to St. Petersburg, started to work on the catalog there, spent a lot of time with the Russians. We were in an old, ancient cab with a Mongolian driver, you know, and we're headed to the airport, and they said, Misha, you know, got in the novice Ruskia, you know, I'm like, I like it, it's fun, you guys are great, you know. And they said, well, what do you really think about Russia, you know? And I said, well, you know, to tell you the truth, when I grew up, they told me you were evil and you drank blood and you wanted to bomb us and we had to hide under the desk and there was a special drill and everything. And they started laughing, you know. And they said, our parents told us the same thing about you, you know. You know, and this was serious when I was a kid and when I was a teenager. This was serious, you know. They were really evil, hateful, abnormal people, you know. And so just junk that worldview. They were pleasant, happy, caring, loving, wonderful, human, warm people. You know, they're just over there and we're over here. So you can scratch the second worldview, what your school taught you. You know, just, you have to examine it. And to be attached to it is the first kind of attachment, okay? I think you can go next to your church. I think the main thing there, very obvious, that there's a God, that God created this world. You know, and the first time I openly in New York City talked about how it didn't make sense, I felt like I was almost committing heresy or something. You know, I felt like almost frightened to say it. But it's just ridiculous. You know what I mean? How could there be a creator being who cared about us, who makes everything, and then makes AIDS, makes cancer, makes my mother die of cancer after getting her breast chopped off and big holes put in her and you know, radiated, and what's the point? You know, what are you trying to teach her? You know, okay, maybe she had time to displease God, but what about all these kids, you know, like little tiny kids, infants born with AIDS? Well, what's the point? Why make a being and then give it AIDS to die before it can even think a straight thought? You know, it just doesn't make any sense at all to blame your world on some guy up in the sky, you know what I mean? It's just primitive. I remember talking with Tibetans the first time I went to Dharamsala, and they said, tell us about Christianity, you know, and we heard that you drink your God's blood, you know, and I'm like, no, we wouldn't do that. And they said, well, what's this communion thing, you know? It says you do transformation. That means it turns into the real blood, and then you drink it, you know, and I said, no, it's not like that. And they said, your religion sounds weird, you know? They said, who made the world? I said, God. They said, come on. Everybody knows it was a monkey mating with a deer. You know what I mean? And we had this big debate, you know. And then we just both realized that they're both equally silly. You know what I mean? Like, when I say the world was invented, the first human came from the marriage of a monkey and a white deer or something. You just laugh. But then you say, oh, some guy came, the guy was asleep, he broke a rib out of him, he made a lady, they got together. You know, they ate this apple, there's a snake, you know, and then you're like, come on, you know what I mean? And you have to examine that worldview, you know what I mean? You have to examine it. Is it such an evil thing to believe that somebody created the world? Yes. Why? You can't take responsibility for your own actions. There's a big hurdle you have to get over. If you had the bad karma to be born in this society with that myth, okay, and I'm not saying the teachings of Jesus or anything like that, which are fantastic. I'm saying that particular myth is harmful to you. Why? You think everything bad that you encounter was put there as a test by some big guy, you know, or just he was negligent, you know, or something. But it's not like that, okay? It can't be like that. And that gets in the way of your believing the laws of karma. Very simply that every bad thing that ever happened to you was created by something bad you did to someone else. Like, you have trouble with that. You really don't believe it. In your guts, you don't believe it. In Princeton, they called it visceral presuppositions. You know? Meaning, what your parents put into your insides in the first 10 years of your life. And you have trouble now. You have a spirit, we call it dipa in Tibetan. You have a spiritual obstacle to the idea that every single aspect of your inner and outer life was created by you, and you have to fix it. You see what I mean? And you just have a balk about that. And when I say the proof that karma is true is that everything comes from something similar that came before, you think, oh, that just sounds simplistic. You see what I mean? It doesn't like send a big light off in your head. You see what I mean? And say, oh yeah, I get it. Every time, you know, I'm in a traffic jam, it's because I blocked somebody. And you think that's just too simplistic. And you have a actual spiritual blinders. You have a worldview obstacles put there by your past karma and by your culture. Just wrong. Just flatly wrong. And they're very hard to take off. It's like a horse taking off his own blinders. It's almost impossible. It's almost impossible. You believe all those things. Deep down in your heart, the plane starts to go down, what are you doing? Oh, Jesus. Oh, Jesus. You do. I did. I remember recently. Okay. Okay. No, they're deep down. By the way, I'm not saying that there aren't omniscient beings, there are. And I'm not saying there are not holy beings circling around in this room watching you and trying to help you directly. There are, okay? I'm not saying that Jesus Christ wasn't the Buddha. He was, okay? I'm not saying that. The worldview thing about the creation of the world, refusing to take responsibility for your own life and for your world, is just totally wrong. And until you get over it, you'll be stuck here, okay? You have to overcome that worldview, okay? How about culture? Attachment to the views of your culture, okay? Whatever the New York Times says is true. And whatever the New York Times has on the front page is important. You know what I mean? And the whole Big Bang, you can say science in our case, okay? Science is false. Science doesn't work at all, okay? Why does the atomic bomb go off? If it hurts somebody, it's due to the karma of the people who got hurt. Period. Okay? How does the atomic bomb go off? Oh, a neutron hits another atomic particle and they multiply too fast and the thing blows up. That's the how. Why? Why didn't it go off until 1940s? You see what I mean? That's karma. You got to get used to that. How and why are different. Okay? Science is describing how. Karma is describing why. And you've got to get that straight. Okay, I'm not being simplistic. I'm saying something. If you think it's hard to get over the hurdle of believing in a creator God, how about science? That's really hard. Okay, that's really hard. Okay, I saw a National Geographic article at Don Brown's house in North Carolina, and it was on aging, and there was this beautiful description of aging process, and in the middle was a foldout. You know, not like a Playboy foldout. It was like a body. And it had little arrows towards all the things that get old and fall apart in your body. Every piece had an arrow on it. You know, this is what happens to the liver as you get older. This is what happens to the muscles. This is what happens to the hair. This is what happens to the eyes. This is what happens to the ears. And then at the very bottom was like an act of truth. It said, and we don't know why. You see? It was very beautiful. Like, this is how you get old, but we don't know why you get old, you see? And we don't know why different people age at different rates. We just don't know why. We don't know why a body should replenish itself every 7 years magically, the skin, and then just stop after a while. We don't know why. We don't know why it was alive in the first place, and we don't know why the life drains out of it. And we don't know why that some life drains out faster than others, okay? That's karma. And you have to understand that worldview, or you will never get anywhere. You can't. And this is hard. This is really hard. Go around telling your friends at work science doesn't work. They say, well, where are you going to the doctor this afternoon? You know what I mean? It's hard. It's very, very hard. As you get into the more important worldviews to overcome, it's just more difficult. Okay? It's much, much more difficult. The reason medicine works is the karma of the people being treated. Period. Okay? That's all. If the person being treated doesn't have the karma to get better, they can't get better. And they won't get better, no matter what treatment you use. And that's all. Same with investment strategies, okay? Economic theories. All false. Every single one, false. Everyone you've ever heard of, everyone you were ever taught in school, wrong. Totally wrong, okay? Why? You want to get rich? Just give away things. Period. Okay? What's the implication? What would happen if every... They used to tell us at Princeton Religion Department, the test of a good religion is what would happen if everybody did it. What would happen if everybody gave away, with an understanding of emptiness, their possessions? What would happen? Everybody would get rich. Everybody. What kind of economic theory is that? You see what I mean? What economic theory ever said that everyone on the planet could be extremely wealthy at the same time? Oh, no, no. Resources are limited. Oh, yeah, right. And the web wasn't invented 5 years ago. And $130 billion of commerce now taking place where there wasn't any before. You know, 4 or 5 years ago. Oh, so like amazing things can happen that suddenly create wealth for millions of people overnight. Why do you think that happened? You see, it's karma. It's giving. You see, I mean, it's not impossible at all that everyone in the world would have enough money, and in fact that everybody in the world would enter a tantric paradise and have everything they ever wanted all the time. Period. Okay? The idea that all these ideas about how to distribute wealth, how to share wealth, should it be capitalism, should it be communism, should it be socialism, they're all based on a fallacy. It's not true that there's a lack of wealth or that there's not enough wealth for everybody. That's not where wealth comes from. Marx's big idea, you know, everything comes from the dirt. Whosoever controls the dirt controls production. You know what I mean? It's just wrong. Whosoever controls the first perfection controls all the money in the world. Really. No cent of the economy of the world at this moment was not created by the personal generosity of the person who has got it. Period. There is no other economics, you know, that doesn't exist. But you have trouble with it, you see. You're still Shemba Shidel. You're not Shemba Shidel. You're Shemba Del, Mado. Okay, you're not disconnected yet from those attachments to your worldview, okay? It's the hardest thing in the world, because what's the karma to have a worldview? What's the karma to have all these wrong views? Killing animals is good, we should give the kids a week off. Some big guy is responsible for cancer. He's a nice guy and he can do everything, but, you know. And there's not enough money for everybody. Where do these worldviews come from? What's the karma of having those worldviews? Why were you born in a society that holds those worldviews? Because you had them in the past, okay? It makes them really nasty. It makes them chronic. You see what I mean? To have them is to have them later. You see what I mean? To have them now is to have them later. And they're the hardest thing to break out of. Nagarjuna called it breaking out of the egg. You know, ripping out of the egg, trying to break the shell and get out. It's the hardest thing, is to break your worldview trap that you're in. You see what I mean? Very hard, extremely hard. Who else can we pick on? I had some more, but I don't remember them. Let me see. Oh, how about the law? What's legal? You see? Right now it's legal to kill fetuses, which according to Lord Buddha, and you can forget the tricycle article about it, Lord Buddha, who states it no less than 1,000 times in the sutras, killing a being after the moment of conception is murder. Okay? Abortion is murder. Period. But the law says it's okay. But it wasn't okay before. Okay? In my, where I grew up in Phoenix, Arizona, it was called Running Numbers. And my mom came. I was reading the newspaper. I used to read the newspaper every morning at breakfast. And I asked my mom, what's Running Numbers? She says, oh, only people in South Phoenix do that. And I said, well, what is it? Oh, it's only those bad people down in South Phoenix, you know, the poor people. And I said, well, what is Running Numbers? You know, and she said, oh, it's like heroin and boxing and drugs and all that stuff. Well, come on, what's Running Numbers? Well, everybody goes to this dark basement and they give this sinister man a number written on a piece of paper. And then he collects them and takes $50 from everybody. And then they put all the numbers in a hat and they pick out one of the numbers, and then that person wins all the money. And that's a felony in the state of Arizona. And, you know, I don't know, 15 years in jail. And the sinister guy gets a cut of the action. And that's running numbers. Now the state of New Jersey, the state of New York is running numbers. Now it's okay. Now it's legal. You see what I mean? The government does it. You see what I mean? And what I mean to say is that the nation in which you live, the country in which you live, what is considered legal will just turn like that. It'll just shift like that. It's just somebody's karma for this to be legal right now. Okay, you can forget running your life. Many of the things which are legal are immoral. Many things which are immoral are legal. And you can't run your life by that worldview. And there will be times when you have to break it. Okay? That you shouldn't break the model there. Okay? Like, you can't look at that for your worldview. Your worldview has to be something that you come to through pure logic, independent of what you grew up with. Okay? Very hard. Extremely difficult. Okay? And then what your country says is right. Okay? Like, Americans have this unique arrogance, you know, about what's right for the rest of the world, you know. And, you know, I was 20, I was traveling through India telling people how they should do things. That's not how you should sweep the floor. Put a stick on that broom, you know. Stand up and sweep the floor. You can't sweep the floor like that. That's not how we do it, you know. You know what I mean? You can't speak English. I don't know what's wrong with you, Hindi or whatever you talk. You know, and it's just this thing. It's the worldview it's this parochial worldview. C.S. Lewis calls it the fish knife thing. You know, at the age of 6, you go to your neighbor's house and there's a strange shaped knife there, and you say, "What's that?" And they say, "That's a fish knife for cutting fish." And you say, "No, it's not." And they say, "Yes, it is." And they say, "No, it's not. It's not the one we have in our house." You see what I mean? And a lot of your worldviews are that. You think that the rest of the world should run by our worldview. The American worldview. And if they don't, then you'll send troops or cut off their foreign aid. Okay? And that's just, you believe that. It's not what's right or wrong, it's just that what your country says, right? So you have to examine, to be attached to, also, even Buddhist worldviews. Okay? There's a hierarchy. There's a hierarchy. Lord Buddha taught the four great schools of India. And then he taught Tantra. And then people get into Vaibhashika, the lowest school, and they say, "Oh, the Sautantrikas are wrong." You know what I mean? They're evil. You know, and the Sautantrikas say, "No, you're backwards." You know, and then you get up to, you know, Mind Only. And they say, "Oh, you both are backwards." And they say, "No, you're evil." You know, then you get up to Majjhimika Svatantrika. And they say, "No, all three of you are mupamawas. That's lousy. You believe functional things are self-existent." And they say, "No, you're evil. You don't even believe in the self-existence of things, you know." And then the Prasangika says to the Svatantrika, "No, you're crazy. You think that the self is the consciousness, the awareness of your thoughts. Are you crazy?" They say, "No, you're nihilist. You're Prasangika. Nagarjuna is a nihilist. He doesn't believe in anything. He thinks nothing's anything, right?" And then the non-tantric schools say, the tantric schools, "You're really crazy. You think you're going to become a god in this life? You know, what do you think?" You know, and then the lower tantric schools say, the higher tantric schools, "You're filthy, you're dirty, you're insane, the practices, I can't believe it, you know, dancing, all the other stuff." You know, and so it's this hierarchy in your practice. And there's a hierarchy in the speed with which things work and the power of the practice. You know what I mean? You have to know all the Buddhist schools. You have to master all the Buddhist schools. You have to understand why Lord Buddha taught them all, which we're going to get into next class. Okay? And then you have to move up the ladder as fast as you can. You cannot be attached to your current comfortable level of practice. Even that, you have to give up. Okay? Even that lower Buddhist worldviews, you have to be willing to chuck them or understand why you have to move up beyond them when the time comes. You are sworn by your bodhisattva vows to work up that ladder as fast as you can. And to understand, appreciate, embrace, as the word of Lord Buddha, all the lower schools, understand why Lord Buddha taught them, and not practice them until you, and then move up, okay? You're sworn to do that. You know, how many people in this country are really practicing Dzogchen? How many practicing Kyurem? How many are just sitting reciting sadhanas? I don't know. You know what I mean? But you are sworn by your vows to move up this ladder as fast as you can. But people get attached to what's comfortable. And Drapa Gyaltsen attacks it. Drapa Gyaltsen, you know, the biggest Dzogchen groomer of all time for Vajrayogini, is like attacking that. He says, you can't get attached to your current level of practice. You have to keep moving up. In tennis, during season, they wouldn't let us play with girls. The coach had a rule. You always had to play with somebody better than you during season. You were not allowed to play with someone who wasn't better than you, because that would force you to get higher. I used to do rowing crew in college, and we had to go weightlift. Every day you had to lift more than the last session. Every single time you had to do 5 pounds more, 3 pounds more, 1 pound more, it doesn't matter, but you have to do more than last time. You have to run a little farther, you have to run up the stadium steps a little faster, every time. And your practice has to be the same. You can't get attached to what's comfortable. You have to, each day, move on and move up to the higher practices, because you are sworn to do that by your bodhisattvas. You are sworn to get this goal accomplished as fast as you can. And then I personally, it seems that people get attached to a certain level and then they just freeze. 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, they just sort of freeze at a certain level, and they don't study more, they don't try to push themselves further, they don't take, I think you have to be, with weightlifting or with yoga or with dance or with any kind of physical thing, you have to take a bit of a risk. You have to be willing. If you're really interested in saving humanity, you know, then sometimes you're going to have to take a shot. Sometimes you'll fall down. I had this teacher in college. They tell you, try to make a move. You have to try to make the move. And once in a while, you'll fall down and you'll hurt yourself. But if you don't keep trying the new ones, you don't get better. And your whole goal of your life is to reach tantric enlightenment now, as fast as you can. And you're fighting a war against time. Your body is falling apart. Your personal world is falling apart. Your karma is wearing out. Your mind is getting duller by the year. Okay? No, after a certain age. You know, your senses. Why don't they take Air Force pilots after 23? You know, I saw that... who was it? The Green Bay Pack... No, the Vikings. Largest amount of men over the age of 30 in the whole NFL. 30. There's 15 guys over the age of 30. 3 guys over the age of 35. What do you think they're trying to tell you? Your vitality drops. You won't be able to meditate so well. You won't be able to think so well. Your eyes and your ears and everything else will start to degenerate. You don't have time to get stuck at a certain level. You see, I mean, you have to keep pushing on and keep pushing on to get higher. And at each point, as you release each of these worldviews, at each point, you will take some heat for it, okay? And get used to it. It's part of the process, okay? At each point in the Buddha's teaching, as you go up the 4 schools, each of the lower schools attacks the higher schools. The most bitter opponents of Nagarjuna, Jeton Kapa, Ken Rinpoche, guess who? The lower Madhyamika school, the mind-only school. You guys are stupid. You guys are crazy. You guys are nihilists. You don't believe in anything, you know. Each time you move up slightly in that pecking order, evolution, it'll be hard, especially with worldviews, okay? Especially with worldviews. And the only way to break out of a worldview is to get some infusion of new worldviews. That's why you have to study. That's why you have to go to great lamas. That's why you have to keep pushing it. Keep reading, keep studying, keep trying to meet as many holy lamas as you can, and then they break you out of your old worldview. See what I mean? That's the only thing that can really do it. And your own virtue, your own kalwa, your own willingness to do good deeds, good karma, because that karma boosts you above where you were before. Okay? It's very, very hard to break out of worldviews, and it requires more karma than any other thing to break out of the worldview that you grew up with. You know, you laughed at the ones I talked about tonight. You have thousands of worldviews that you wouldn't laugh about if I attacked them. You got a little quiet when I get to science. Okay? All right? No, but you have to move up. And the only way to do it is kalwa. Kalwa, good deeds. Keep your vows, keep your book. Actively go out looking for good things to do for people. Actively go out and think of good things to do for great lamas like Lama Sopa, like helping him with fire offering stuff. stuff like that. And then that just pushes you over your next threshold. And there are many thresholds to go over. Don't be attached to your old worldviews. That's the first of the four attachments, okay? And that's the holy teaching from Jetson Dapa Gyantsen. Okay, take a break. It's a holy name to hear. Okay. I just thought of something to talk about. Okay. I heard that you guys finished the talk about how to deal with families and stuff like that. So I thought we'd go on to something else. Debbie Bai, how much did we cop here? How many quid? Over $200. Okay. That's nice. Which brings up the subject. Okay. We get asked a lot. I get asked a lot. People come to me and say, so-and-so is giving initiation this weekend. Should I go? You know what I mean? Like some lama is coming into town and should I go? And then people say, I know such and such a lama. Should they come and could they come and teach at ACI? You know, or something like that. And I want to tell you that I'll just throw out my thoughts about it, and then you tell me what you think about it. But I think my first thought is that I think in spiritual things in general, there's already too much division between people. You know what I mean? Like there's my center and your center and my Galupa center and your Galupa center and my Debung Galupa center and your Debung Galupa center and my Gomang Debung Galupa center and your Gomang Debung Galupa center. And there's like that. And I think there's too much of that. And I had a dream, I think I told you one night, very strong in a Vajrayogini retreat. And I'm sitting around a table with a bunch of newsmen and they're interviewing the Dalai Lama, His Holiness. And I'm sitting next to the Dalai Lama, you know, and I get to translate something. And then they say, His Holiness, since things are empty, we don't have to practice morality anymore, right? So I'm like, I go like this, and I say, you know, let me answer him. I'll blow him away, you know? And he looks at me like that, and he says, you know, sometimes, Michael, it's more important to have harmony than to be right. You know, and it was very powerful. It was a very strong dream. So I think in general, my general feeling is that there's so much division. There's so much lack of harmony. And I think the very first Bodhisattva vow is a symbol or a sign that that's been going on for a few thousand years maybe. You know, the first Bodhisattva vow is, it says Dr. Shenme, Chunomita Shing. Don't praise yourself, don't put down others. But it specifically means don't praise your group, your Mahayana group specifically, and put down another Mahayana group, you know, and that teacher or something like that, out of feelings of like possessiveness, pride, whatever, out of some kind of negative feelings, that you feel like attached to your group for the wrong reasons. And I think so in general, just it feels to me like there's been so much division. And even in the Tibetan tradition, there's been so much division. And in every tradition, I mean, American also. I mean, Tibetans asked me, what did you grow up? And I said, I don't know, it's 300 Protestant sects in America. They said, well, how does yours differ from the other 299 when you were growing up? I said, I don't even know. You know, I used to go to my friend's church and they would recite something and they'd have a different word in the Lord's Prayer and we'd say it was no good. You know what I mean? And so I think that it just feels to me like His Holiness is on the right track. You know what the only thing that His Holiness asked me when we gave him the CD-ROM was, do you have the Bumbo text on there? It wasn't even the Buddhist text, you know. It was like, are there Bumbo texts, Bon texts on there? And I said, you know, I changed the subject. But anyway. I think there's too much division already. I think that we should try to reach out to other groups. I think as far as possible, we should try to have great lamas come if they can. And I think we should try to reach out and to try to learn from other people. And I really believe that, and I think we should try to do that. Now I'll talk about the other side of it. And by the way, I think, like someone asked me, could God still be used by a certain person, a certain lama, a certain group. And I said, yes, I think that's fine. I think it's good. Even another group has asked us if they could use Gusto. And I said, as long as we don't have any programs that week, as long as there's no one who's going to be disturbed who's in a lay room retreat or something like that, and if the place is there, and if someone wants to use it for a nice spiritual retreat, then I think it's wonderful. And then they said, should they pay? And I said, well, I think it'd be kind of cool to give it to them for free, if we could. And then tell them if they want to pay for it, this is how much it costs to open it for that weekend, but if you can't pay, it's okay. And I think that if there were more of that going on, I think it'd be very, very beautiful. Then they said, could we sponsor it? And I said, no. You know, and so that's a different thing, you know, to say that we sponsor this thing or that we put our name behind a teaching that I have no idea what the content is going to be. I don't personally know this teacher. They said they're a geshe, you don't have to worry about it. Okay. I'm not putting down geshe, I'm just saying geshe is not a ticket to being, you know, correct. Except in my case. Okay, but anyway. No, I just mean that you have to know the person. You have to check the person. One time this Geshe guy showed up. He says, he's Geshe. I said, really? Where from? He says, oh, this college. I said, oh, really? When did you finish? He says, well, I'm almost finished, you know. And I said, oh, how much did you finish? He says, I got you the Parchin. Parchin is first year, you see. And, you know, and then I'm like, yeah. I mean, it doesn't, you see signs up says Geshe so-and-so. Ex-abbot of so-and-so, pretty good friends of the Dalai Lama, so-and-so. The Om group came to 39th Street when Pelma and I were there. These are the people who attacked people on the Tokyo subways with gas. They had a picture of their leader reaching out towards His Holiness as if they were shaking hands. Later it turns out he just did that at the side of the road and they took a picture, you know what I mean? But it didn't sound right to me. Everything sounded funny, you know? What I'm saying is that I wouldn't have a person, I wouldn't sponsor a talk or a teaching by a person unless I knew who they were, unless they were well recommended, unless I knew that their personal background, and unless I knew that their worldview was correct. Personally, I wouldn't support it. And it doesn't mean that they're a bad person or something like that. No, there's another extreme too. I told you the story many times. The guy calls me up, says he's the leader of Mongolian Buddhism. I say, oh, great, you know, what's your name? He says, Jetsun Damba, you know, and I said, well, what monastery are you from? He says, I'm not from any monastery. So I'm like, yeah, right, you know, and I said, well, what, were you from Ulaanbaatar or where? He says, I've never been to Mongolia. You know, so I'm like, well, who are you? You know, he says, oh, well, I'm the head of Mongolian Buddhism. You know, and I said, well, it's nice to talk to you, you know, maybe I'll catch you sometime. Then I go out to Ken Rinpoche, I said, I met this guy, he gave me the spiel on the phone. He says, you made a big mistake. You know? He is, you know. By the way, he's just been reinstated in his throne in Mongolia, and he really is, you know. And, you know, I went to, his two sons are my classmates in the monastery. They never mentioned about it, their father. Okay. Anyway, I'm saying you can make big mistakes. So I'm not judging that the person is not capable of teaching. I'm just saying I don't know them. And I don't know their background. And your mental real estate, your spiritual real estate is very impressionable, very valuable. So I wouldn't, I mean, if you've checked the person out, if you know them to be good, you know, get like Lama Sopa, I mean, has done such extraordinary things for people throughout the history of American Buddhism for year after year after year, 24 hours a day, burning out his body. To help people, thousands and thousands of activities just to benefit people, you know, totally from his heart, totally giving, you know. Of course, if you have a chance, I think during the coming year, if 2000, we should try to have him give some talks here and things like that. Art Engel, I think, should try to come. We should try to get him here once a month or something. Try to get Ken Rembrandt here a couple of times in 2000, things like that. I think you have to grab the opportunity when it comes. I sort of discouraged the idea of quick weekend talks, you know, like come in town Friday night, leave Sunday morning, cover the Lama Rinpoche in between, you know. I discouraged that. I think it's, as you've seen at this institute, the idea is you have at least an 8 to 10 weeks course, you know, and you have lots of time to think, and and that it's part of a larger program of study that could go on for years and takes you through. If I go all around the United States for those two nightstands, I don't like them. I actually refuse them when I can. I say 4 or 5 days, 10 classes, okay, but less than that, I don't see where I could have much benefit. And I don't like that. And that's all they get. And they get the same thing over and over again. People get crazy. You know, the Lama comes into town, teaches the Lojong Tse Gema, does the short Lam Rim, gives a long life Tar initiation, and then blows out of town by Sunday evening. You know what I mean? And it just frustrates people after a while. So I think those are the considerations you have to have. Now, what kind of teaching? Ken Rinpoche always used to say that if you try to mix the four traditions of Tibet, you will have a problem. Not that they are not each pure. They are all pure. They're all beneficial. They're like the four schools of ancient India. They are beautiful, great. Each one is perfect for a certain kind of disciple, and you have to find the one that's perfect for you. You know what I mean? Like, you have to decide and pick one. But it's like, but then to go and try to do two of them at once or three of them at once, it's like, when I grew up, they told us that if you used Ajax and Clorox at the same time, you'd kill yourself. And of course, we tried it and nothing happened. But individually, they're great. But I can't remember, she used to always tell us that. And I never regretted that. I got fed a pure, holy, sacred Jetsun Kapa Gelugpa diet, and I'm not ashamed of it. It's fantastic. It's perfect. You can get enlightened that way. You don't need anything else. You know, people ask me, how many tantric initiations you have? I said, one. And they said, well, gee, I had 14, you know. I said, I don't care. You know, like, just do your thing, you know, do that one thing purely. You don't need more than that. So I don't think, I'm not disrespecting the other traditions. And I'm also not to the point of feeling apologetic where I think we have to have at least one Chinese master here a year or one Nyingma master here a year or one Kagyu master here. I don't think like that. You know what I mean? If it's relevant to our immediate study, you know, if it's, for example, that you have some advanced students who are doing serious Vajrayogini studies, and they've gotten back to the original Sakya works, and if there's a holy great master of the Sakya tradition who'd be willing to come and help us with those texts or help us with a certain part of our own tradition, I think it's beautiful. I think it'd be great. But again, great study of that person's character, their background, what they're doing, what they're teaching, how their worldview is. Are they really a master of what they do? You guys are spoiled because you grew up on Ken Rinpoche, who is a true master. There's nobody left like him alive in southern India. In the great Gelugpa monasteries, out of 10,000 monks, there's nobody like that. But you just take it for granted. You don't realize that the kind of training he's had, and just offhand imparts you stuff that you couldn't get anywhere else in the world, you just take it for granted because you didn't know anything else. So, I mean, there are lots of people less qualified. There are lots of people who didn't quite finish class number 5 through 18. You see what I mean? And you just don't even know about it. Somebody comes, they have a red robe on, they have some kind of degree from somewhere. You have to check them out, you have to know what they know. So that's my feeling on it personally. I think you have to reach out to other traditions. I mean, you have to be, there's too much division going on, and it's harmful. If a Lama has proven themselves to be a great teacher and a great person and a great servant of their disciples, then I think we should work, like I'm thinking of Lama Sopa or something like that. I think we should work very hard to try to get them to teach here when we can. If it's someone who's supposed to be great, but we don't know about them, I think we have to learn more about them or ask other, the great Lamas that we know, we have to ask them, is this Lama qualified? And do you want to have them teach here? If they're from another Tibetan tradition, I think, in general, it would confuse you if you got extensive teachings from more than one tradition. I think you got a taste of it if you read the Kagyu Lojong, and then the Sakya Lojong, and then the Gelugpa Sojong. They're all beautiful, but if you don't have the right kind of teacher and the right explanations for the Kagyu Lojong that you had, for example, you just plain get confused, you know. The nature of the mind is nothing, you know. The truth, the path itself is gone beyond. You know what I mean? And you need someone who's well-trained to explain it. So I think you would get confused. Again, if a person is a highly qualified master of of one of our lineages that stretches beyond the Galupa beginnings. For example, we're studying Sotik in the Vinaya class. Kunkyan Sonawa was born 200 years before the Galupa started. But we're studying that text for our Vinaya class because it's the greatest. It's a Kagyu text. You see what I mean? The people tell me, oh, you're Galupa, you don't like the Kagyus. I said, yeah, and I spent, 12 years studying Vinaya with a Kagyu text, but it's not like that. You see what I mean? So if it's a great Lama who relates to your lineage, if you're strong in your lineage and you understand your lineage well and the teachings well, then naturally reach out further to get more teachings from holy beings on those subjects, okay? As far as the interfaith dialogue, you know what I mean? Like Christian, Jewish, Hindu, Muslim. I don't like it for the sake of political correctness. You know what I mean? If it's just for that, to be politically correct, every year we should have a rabbi here so we can say we had a rabbi here. You know, Rinpoche and I once got invited to Lakewood, New Jersey to the Pope had just issued a, what do you call those things? A new encyclical or something. I don't know. What do they call those things? Anyway, it was something he announced that you had to have more people from other religions come and give talks at Catholic churches, you know? So this church in Lakewood asked me and Rinpoche to go talk there, not because they wanted to hear what we said, but because they were required by this instructions that we had to go, they had to have at least one per year. So we were the representative Buddhists, you know what I mean? And it just felt very uncomfortable, and actually the people were very beautiful, and we ended up having a good time. But the motivation behind it, just for correctness, I don't think so. If it's a true desire to learn more and to learn from those people about the holy teachings of their great teachers or something like that, I think there's a place for it. And I think there'd be a sweet place for it, but not as just a gesture as a real taking the time to learn what they teach, to learn what they know, to benefit from what they know, like how the Christians run their charities, how the great Christian charities run, like even Salvation Army type of thing, or how those successful places work, because the Buddhists are lousy at it. We don't do anything. There's no Tibetan Buddhist charities in India. They just started the first one at Sera. It's a free hospital. But the concept of a free hospital 10 years ago would have been unheard of in the monastery. It would have said, you're crazy. You know what I mean? And that kind of stuff, I think we have to be very open and frank about what we don't know, what we don't have in our tradition, and what we can learn from other traditions. But not just this PC stuff. You know? Those are my thoughts on it. And as far as the course, as I'll repeat from an earlier talk, it's pure Buddha, Arya Nagarjuna, Chandrakirti, Dharmakirti, Master Shantideva, pure 100% original text. There isn't anything in there that's, there's no major part of the 18 courses which is not a direct translation of the classics. That's why the place is called Asian Classics. There's nothing there that was made up by anybody or anything like that. And the information you've been taught, every homework question, it's pure 100% the great masters of Buddhism, all the way back to Lord Buddha. There's nothing else there. And I think it should stay that way. And I think it should be that way. The instruction itself should be pure 100% what the Buddha taught and what the great masters have taught since then. I anticipate that in the coming decades, there will be American commentaries on those things, and I think that's wonderful. And you should write commentaries, your students should write commentaries. Within 200 years of the move of Buddhism to Tibet, the Sanskrit books were gone. By Jetsun Kapa's time, nobody studied the originals in Sanskrit. You see what I mean? It was all the Tibetan commentaries. So I think the same thing might well happen in English, but you goddamn well better be qualified to write them. Okay, that's all. That's my idea about it. Do you guys have anything to say about, interfaith or any other traditions? You want to go home? Okay. Yeah.
Do you mention
Matthew asked if you think it'd be useful to have debates. I can see two things happening. I can see marriages. Like, I have some great students who came from the Zen tradition. And they are really good at meditating. And then I think they came here and learned more content for the meditation. So there was this, I can see places where the lineages can marry, you know what I mean? Like, you have a great Zen tradition of how to sit and sitting discipline and how to concentrate well. And then you get the content poured in. I can see that. And then, yeah, I can see debates. And I'm not, when I say reach out and have unity and stuff like that, there should also be very frank, open debates, public debates, on certain points. You see what I mean? And I should be gloves off. You know what I mean? And they say Senge Ngaro. Say Senge?
Senge.
Ngaro.
Senge?
Senge. Ngaro. No, be nice to that lineage. Be respect that lineage. Speak well of them. Appreciate them. Learn from them. Listen to them. But when they give that bullshit explanation of emptiness, Senge Ngaro means attack them with the roar of a lion, you know, publicly. Say, or abortion, you know, the Tricycle magazine drives me crazy, you know. Did the Buddha outlaw abortion? Of course he did. I can show you 400 or 500 places in the scriptures where he did. You know, come on, you know what I mean? And then you have to be willing to stand up and say, come on, that's obviously wrong. And then you have to be ready to debate it. I think that'd be wonderful. Like this idea that emptiness is some kind of colored light or something like that. Just something totally wrong. Then they, yeah, should be willing to debate it. You show me. Some guy came up to me and said, anger is a good thing for you. They said so in the scriptures, you know, gets it out, you feel better. I said, show me, you know, just show me. Come next week and show me the scripture. You know, in 4,500 works in the Buddhist canon, the Kangyur and Tengyur, there's not a single line that says that. Come and show me next week. He did. Next week he brought me this book. It's by this guy who made up this thing. And, you know, oh, this is my source, you know. So I said, you said it was in the scriptures. This guy's still alive. He just made this up. So I said, show me a scripture, you know. He couldn't. He left. He never came back. He wrote me a nasty letter, but... No such thing. You see, that's all. Yeah, that'd be great. That'd be great. But under very controlled circumstances and with great respect for each other's tradition. You know what I mean? To say that the Vaibhashikas are crazy or, you know, is to put down their teacher. Who is who? Lord Buddha. Okay, so, yeah, you got to be careful about that. I mean, Lord Buddha might have taught Hatha Yoga. Lord Buddha might have taught, you know, certain kinds of baseball. I don't know, but you got to be... Looks like, but you gotta be careful. You really have to be careful. We don't know. You really don't know. I mean, the very first bodhisattva vow is not there by accident. It's that you must have a deep respect for the other traditions and honor them. Each one, if Buddha could teach Vaibhashika, then Buddha could teach anything else to help people. So you can't diss it, but you have to. When there's a case where you have an opportunity to debate in a proper setting and with great respect for each other, I think we have to do it like that. Okay? I think we have to stop tonight. We'll do a prayer. Okay? Thank you.